He's on David and his life, and this is a third part. And 2 weeks ago, we talked about charging your Goliaths. Remember the living God, that when everybody was frightened, David introduced a whole new factor into the situation, and that was the living God. He charges Goliath, and that's why he was called a man after God's own heart. And he's a hero in Israel when this happens in chapter 17, and we're going to pick it up in chapter 18. Because while he's a hero and great things are going on, God's got his plan, and God is moving, but he's going to be moving in a different way. And there's really two main characters here in this text. It's Saul and there's David. Now, Saul is the present king, he's the first king of Israel, but due to his sloppiness in his Christian life, not being a man after God's own heart, the Lord had said to him in chapter 13, a few chapters earlier, that God was going to remove him as king because the Lord was seeking a man after his own heart to be the leader of the people. And so Saul's under discipline right now, and Saul's basically on his way out as king. But so he's losing position, Saul. He's losing power. He's losing popularity. He's losing status, comfort. Even his family is going to kind of shatter. Now, David, on the other hand, while he's a hero and everything's going great, he just conquered Goliath, he too is going to be going through some difficult times. And he's about to lose reputation, his family, his security, his job, his best friend, his wife, his self-respect. But for him, it's going to be a whole different angle on why that's happening to him. For him, it's going to be a maturing issue. For Saul, it's a disciplining issue. But they're both going to be going through disappointment, suffering, loss, frustration, confusion, and it's all part of God's sovereign plan in their lives. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to pick it up here in chapter 18, and we're going to see two very different responses to pain and suffering and disappointment and loss. One is Saul, and the other is David, and how it all pans out. And so, let's begin reading in verse 1 of chapter 18. Now, really, I encourage you to read, just begin reading the story of David just in these weeks. And really, today is a summary of chapters 18 to 20. But I'm only really focusing on the first 12 verses. But let's begin in verse 1. This is right after the conquering of Goliath, and David is now a hero. It says, after David finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. Jonathan was Saul's son. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David along with his tunic, and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. And whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. And when the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs, with tambourines and lutes. And as they danced, they sang, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. And Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. The next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully upon Saul, and he was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp, as he usually did. And Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying to himself, I'll pin David to the wall, but David eluded him twice. All right, so, now, this is not exactly my favorite topic about loss and disappointment and pain and all that. In fact, I don't know how you're doing with the election, but there's something going on with the election this year. There's a campaign called Work to Live, and there's a group of people trying to get the government to make mandatory minimally 4 weeks vacation a year for everybody. What a wonderful idea. And this article talked about how we're the most burnt out, exhausted people on the planet. We've now beat Japan. We've worked 50 to 60 hour weeks, but there's no mandatory vacation policy in America. But in places like Spain and France, they are mandatory that they have to give every worker 6 weeks off a year. Isn't that nice? So whatever candidate votes for this, we go for them, all right? Now, nonetheless, God doesn't always work like that in terms of what he brings into our lives. And God is going to bring something very painful into both Saul's life and David's life. And again, for Saul, you're going to watch him. He's going to have a spiral downward into self-destructiveness. David, on the other hand, is going to have a spiral upward towards some spiritual maturity and wholeness. So two very similar things happen to them in different ways, but two very different responses. And so let's begin with the overhead up. And I want to begin just talking about Saul and his downward spiral. And again, I call it a spiral. It's a slow downward spiral. I think of a spiral staircase. It's not just straight down. Most of our lives are like that. When we're going downhill, it kind of goes in circles, you know? But the path in general is going down. And many of you know what it's like to have your life on a path of destructiveness, where just one thing leads to another, to another, to another, but it's a slow path downward. Now, you'll notice there is a slow downward spiral to self-destruction, because nobody spirals down quickly. Everybody spirals down very slowly, and Saul is no exception. Now, Saul, if you read earlier in the book of Samuel, he starts out great. The guy's handsome. He's tall, probably 6'5", 6'6". He's magnetic when he walks in the room. He's got lots of charisma. He's gifted. He's anointed by God to be the king. The Spirit of God is on him. I mean, he is chosen to be God's anointed to be the first king of Israel. He's got it all. The problem is he's very sloppy in his walk with God. And he's what we call a sluggard. Remember the book of Proverbs? He is a sluggard in his walk with God. And so, you know, he does God's will, but he just doesn't bother to do all of it. And he trusts God, he just doesn't want to trust God all the way. And so, you know, for example, when God sends him out to conquer the Amalekites, and God says, wipe everybody out, that's my act of judgment, don't hold on to the wealth. Well, Saul just takes a little bit of the wealth and takes the king as a ransom, because he's concerned about his own security long term. And so he does God's will, he just doesn't do all of it. So what happens, he's always taking life in his own hands. He's very impatient. And so God disciplines him. And if you know anything about our God, our Father, Hebrews 12 makes it very clear. God disciplines those sons and daughters whom he loves. And so Saul is disciplined by God for his disobedience and for constantly moving aside. And the Lord tells him he's going to remove him as the king. He's going to suffer some humiliation and loss and pain. He's going to reap basically what he has sown. Now, you're going to say Saul's a dad. He's got a dream for his kids and his grandkids and a dynasty. This is a major blow for him. And the way Saul deals with this pain and disappointment is, you're going to notice, he gets very frustrated. He gets anxious. He gets very angry. He gets jealous. He ends up in a rage and eventually ends up leaving God completely and going into witchcraft. Now, in chapter 18 to 20, you'll see six different attempts, and he finally goes after murdering David. He does not want this pain to come into his life. So he goes after David six different times, a couple of times with a javelin, three times with a javelin, two times he tries to lure him to his death by putting him into the front of a battle to get himself killed against the Philistines. He actually sends in a death squad himself, sends out basically the CIA and the FBI, his best hitmen, to go after David for quite a while, a number of years. He is going to go after David. He's going to kill him. But in fact, at one point, he wants David to marry one of his daughters at the bounty of 100 foreskins from the Philistines, which is kind of for David to have some wealth to bring to Saul, the king. But his goal really is to get David secretly killed. Now, foreskins are, the Philistines were not circumcised. So David goes, and you thought scalps were bad. David goes and gets 200 foreskins, all right, and brings them back. I mean, this is good TV here. This is a serious story. But he's trying to get David killed, and through all kinds of ways. And it starts out very slow and secretive and trying to get rid of David. By the end, he's in a complete rage of outright trying to kill him. But we pick it up here in chapter 18. It's kind of the beginning of the downward spiral. We're kind of like we're just after the beginning. And you'll notice that in verse 6, all the people are singing. Now, they're happy Goliath's been killed. But they're singing that, verse 7, Saul has slain his thousands, but David is tens of thousands. And Saul, in verse 8, is very, very angry. Now, he begins by nursing this anger. Now, I don't know about you, but there's all kinds of anger, right? There's repressed anger. Then there's explosive anger. And he starts out probably depressed and grows into explosiveness. And it looks differently for all of us, doesn't it? We all have anger. Anger is a human emotion. It comes to all of us. And, you know, some of us nurse it a lot with sarcasm and hostile silence or sharp remarks or put-downs or insults. And some of us get very cold gestures, or we have temper tantrums or outbursts. And some of us get verbally abusive. Some of us slam doors and throw things. And some of us hold grudges and pout. And some of us have this thing called free-floating anger, you know, and hostility. It's kind of camouflage. It's a kind of undercurrent anger that reveals itself in different moments and body movements, and quick to notice the faults of other people and be critical and nasty and demanding and argumentative. You know people like that. I know you're not, but they're out there, you know, hypersensitive. And we need to recognize that's what's coming to us. Saul is getting angrier and angrier, but he's not picking up the signs. He's not dealing with it. It's just free-floating hostility manifesting in different ways, and it just slips by him. Now, when we get angry, and Jesus got angry at times too, and it's in your anger do not sin, it is meant to be a beacon. It's meant to be a lighthouse inside of us for self-knowledge, and it's meant to be a source of change in our lives. It's meant to allow God to do something in us, but he's missing it all. And his anger then becomes jealousy in verse 9 as he gets very jealous. He keeps a jealous eye on David. And the other thing about jealousy, from the great sins from Genesis to Revelation, Satan himself was jealous. That's what caused him to fall from heaven. But it says in Corinthians, it Paul says, love is not envious or jealous. That once you get into jealousy, love's out the window. In fact, in James, it says love comes from below. It's diabolical. It's the opposite of heavenly wisdom. And you know what jealousy is like, isn't it? When you look at another person's success and you say, I hate that. I deserve that. Or maybe you have something and they've got it too, but you're saying, but I deserve it and they don't. I worked hard for it. You know, someone's getting married and you can't rejoice in them getting married. You're saying, I want to be married. I deserve to be married right now. Or someone gets a promotion at work and you're angry and you're frustrated. You say, I should have got that promotion at work. Or someone's making double your salary and you say, you know what? I'm as smart as them. I should be making that money, and I'm not. And it goes to everything. We get jealous over people's possessions and their beauty and their intellect and their relationships and their position and their success. It goes on and on. And so he's got, and it happens to all of us, doesn't it? This issue of just, it's envy. And again, he doesn't let it be a beacon to go inside to wrestle, to transform, to drive him to God. Saul's just, he's not going in. He's just moving. And so his jealousy of David grows and grows and grows. And he could not be happy with the honor that David was getting. In fact, it's upsetting him. And, you know, it's interesting because if you look at the gospel, and I think the way you're supposed to deal with envy, just a little side note, is the very gospel itself is God gives us what we don't deserve. The very heart of the gospel is that God doesn't begrudge us anything. Not just gives us life, he gives us a son, he gives us all good things, all his gifts. We don't deserve anything. And the gospel, as we meditate, let it saturate us, actually is able to set us free from that jealousy and envy and actually cause us to be content. But anyway, don't underestimate envy. But the way that individuals relate to one another is intimately connected to a person's level of conversion and spirituality and relationship with God. If you want to know how a person's relationship with God is, watch their relationship with other people. Saul's is shallow, his walk with God, and thus it works out in the way he relates to people. And so he's going after David here, and in fact, what you do with your anger and your jealousy says also a lot about your spirituality. Saul doesn't do anything with it. In fact, Saul wants to hang on to this kingship more than anything. He's obsessed. We'd call him an addict. He, at any cost, is going to hold on to being king of Israel, and nothing's going to get him off of that. Eventually, an evil spirit comes on him. Now, Saul's obsessed with David. He loses good judgments. And anything that is more important than God in your life becomes really like a drug. Anything that you want more than God really becomes like a cocaine, a crack, a heroin, because whether it's your friends or your career or your family, you've got to have this. And anything that gets in your way, you're going to get rid of it. Saul is obsessed in being king, and it becomes an addictive substance to him, just like it becomes for many of us, and ends up controlling him and more in charge of his life. But basically, he is going to remain as king, and he doesn't care what's going to, God is not going to step him down and put somebody else in that place, and regardless of the consequences. When you want something that bad, All kinds of consequences follow. Some of you know your children are immigrants. And when parents have placed on you expectations to be the success of the family, and the damage that has done to you alone and to your family as a whole, folks who've gone after money and say, I'm going to make X amount if it kills me, and the leftovers or the bodies left behind. The same thing even go on for folks who want to get a degree or whatever obsession it might be, or status. I've got to have this, like Beauty and the Beast. I'm looking for my Prince Charming, or the woman that kissed me, and I'll be a prince, you know? And then my life will be rescued. I want this more than anything. When this kind of driving, or I've got to have this more than God himself, what happens, you end up going eventually up against God, and Saul here is going up against the Word of God, who has said, you're going to be removed from being king. And he rejects it, and he hardens his heart. He rages against this. Now, how many of you know what it's like? How many of you know what it's like to say, you know what God wants, but you say, I don't care. I know what God wants. I don't care. That's where Saul was. It was a slow downward spiral to self-destruction. Now he never used those words, I don't care. But the truth is, he didn't care. So his anger was unleashed, his jealousy was unleashed, he didn't deal with it. And he now is just, he's a very religious guy. If you look closely at the life of Saul, this guy is a serious religious, he's a leader in the church, all right? But he's using God. He's not obeying God. He doesn't love God and to do his will for God's will's sake. He uses God for his own ego, his own purposes. Now, he's proud. He's not listening to people anymore. He's not accountable to anybody. He's not teachable. And what's interesting, because he's at fault and he's held accountable for that downward spiral. At the same time, it says over and over again that an evil spirit comes upon him, which is true. He opens himself up to the demonic, and they're both true. Because it's the work of an evil spirit that caused him to act so crazy and foolish and lack judgment. And you know they're both true? When we say, God, I don't care anymore, I'm on that spiral down, where at some point, you know what, things get crazy. And there's a level of evil going on in our lives that our self-deception is so great, it's almost non-human. A person can say something to us that was so clear, so honest, and we just don't hear it. It's like blinders. It's like there's an evil covering, and it just bounces right off of us. You know, one of the books I read over the summer was The Siege of Stalingrad during World War II in 1942-1943. And at the time, Germany had the most powerful army in the world. And Hitler was winning battle after battle, conquering country after country, and he was going for Russia. And he marches through Kiev and takes 650,000 prisoners, and he's so arrogant. He's so like, we're going to take this thing. And he finally gets to Stalingrad. And it's like, it's September, October. He makes no preparations for a long winter, just in case, because he knows we're gonna roll right over Stalingrad, then go to Moscow. People are trying to tell him, listen, you got practical problems here. In case this battle is extended, you know, you're going to have a problem. You hit the Russian winter. He ignores it. And basically, they end up in a long, protracted battle through the winter. And about 500,000 Russians die, and over 500,000 Germans die, and they lose the battle. And he lets his soldiers basically starve to death through the winter. But what was so striking about the book was that the author, who was a military historian, said he was not a great general because he lived in illusion. He did not want bad news. He only wanted good news. And so because he did not want bad news, he did not want the truth, he actually led his army to great destruction. That's really what Saul is like. He doesn't want to hear the truth. He'd rather live in an illusion. You know, a lot of us are like that too, aren't we? We know what God wants, but we say, you know, I don't care. I'll obey this, this, and this. I'm not going to bother. And we end up saying, why am I going on this? Why is everything going crazy here? You know, how many folks are in a relationship, in a friendship or a relationship with a single person, or in a relationship outside of marriage? You just know it's not right. You know it. But you don't care. You say, you know what? I'm just going. Someone talks to you and you say, well, why are you in my life? Or let's take money. You know, you're involved in some getting yourself in debt or in a position financially that you know is not where you should be. Or you've tightened your fist in terms of generosity that you know you've shut God out. But yeah, you know what? I don't care. I'm moving along. How about Christian disciplines? You know, you stop spending time with God, praying, reading the Word, fellowship, cell, community. You know, it doesn't feel as good as it used to. You know, you're like, you know, I'm just... And God's speaking to you, and He reminds you every now and then, but you just keep putting them off. And like Saul, you know what God's saying, you just don't want to bother. Well, how many of you don't want to even hear God? So I'm not even listening, because you're afraid what He might say. Do you think Saul is listening to God anymore? He's doing sacrifices, he's doing religious things, but he's not listening anymore, because he doesn't want to hear what God has got to say. How many of you today, you really don't want to hear what God has to say? Like Saul, because you know it will disrupt your plans and where you're going. And you're holding on to the kingship, whatever that might look like for you. You're holding on to this, and you're afraid to let it go. And it's spiritual destructiveness. How about using your gifts and talents? God says, I've got something for you. You know it with your gifts, your talents, your abilities. And God says, I've got something for you. But you say, I don't want to go. I don't want to go down that road. And you shut him out. Saul did. Well, I don't know. Saul, I think, did not like short-term pain. He did not understand the principle of delayed gratification. You know what delayed gratification is? I take the pain now, short-term, so I can have the joy later. I take the cross now for the resurrection later. Saul did not like that. Saul wanted resurrection now. Most of us like it that way, too. But I believe God's stopping some of us today because you, like Saul, are going your own way. And you may have started out well, but somehow along the line, slowly, there's been a spiral, and you've gotten yourself on a downward trek, and your heart is no longer as sensitive to the Lord as it used to be. And God is stopping you today and saying, be careful. Now hold on to that right now. Let's go down to the next one. We'll talk about David. Now what's interesting is that Saul destroys not just himself, he destroys his family too. Because when you destroy yourself, you basically take, everybody around you is affected negatively. Now David is also going on a slow upward spiral towards spiritual maturity. Now, he's also going through tremendous suffering. I mean, he's not losing the kingship, but he's losing everything. He's losing his family. He's losing his best friend. He loses his wife. He loses his reputation. He's slandered. He's hated. I mean, David goes through so much loss and pain. Yet, in the midst of it all, in his loss and pain, he goes up. Now, what do you do when you're in pain? He somehow goes up to God. Now, as I wrestle with this, and I say it's a slow going up, because for David, this loss and suffering lasted about 13 to 15 years. Now, I don't know about you. I like the trials that are 30 days or at max. But David's last quite a while. I don't know about Saul's timetable here, but David's struggle and things not going well lasted quite a while. But it's a slow spiral downward. It's a slow spiral upward. And I'm going to give you two factors that I believe are in the text as to how is he able to go up? Because I think for most of us, I know myself, I don't mind. In fact, I don't mind when I'm reaping what I've sown. I can handle that from God, and I can accept that. And I'll kind of dig into a whole lot of debt over time. I'll do that. I'll do the hard thing. I accept the consequences. I have a more difficult time when suffering is in my life and loss and disappointment when I've done nothing to deserve it. That's when I begin to say, you know what, God? Hey! Hey! And I start saying, I'm not going up with you, I'm going down. Now, David in this text is good. He is so good. He's done nothing to deserve all this suffering coming into his life. And in fact, there's nothing up to this point. He will sin later, and we'll see it with Bathsheba and all, but up to this point, the guy has been an ace. So I said, God, give him some slack, please. But he goes through enormous loss, suffering, and pain, and ends up, running for his life for years. Now, there's two factors that really make it happen. The first is found in chapter 18, verses 1 to 5. I'm going to simply call it godly friendship. So why don't you go down. This friendship with Jonathan is one of the great stories of the Bible, and a friendship. But Jonathan was the son of Saul. And Jonathan was the son of the king. Jonathan was supposed to be the next king. He was the heir apparent. And what Jonathan does is Jonathan sees in David Christ. He sees the anointed one. He sees that God's hand is on David, that he is to be king. And Jonathan does what no one's ever done politically, and I'm sure nobody will do it this election either in November. Here's Jonathan. Basically, he wants the election's his. Imagine Bush or Gore saying, after the election's over, one of them wins and says, you know, you are the better candidates, and I am not going to take this presidency. I am going to give it to you. So here is the Bible for the inaugural speech and the swearing, and I am going to be your second in command. Okay, that's what Jonathan does here. It's never been done in the history of politics, I believe. It's unique, but he had the qualifications to be the king, and he had the rights. But he realized that God had called David to be king, and not him. And Saul's evil, even though it's his father, does not get into his spirit at all, Jonathan. And they become friends. It says here they become one in spirit, or they're bound, or they're chained. He loved them of himself. They make a covenant together. And in verse 4, Jonathan takes off his royal robe, and he gives it to David. Then he takes off his sword. The sword is so significant. And he's saying, it's yours. He basically gives to David the kingship. And I say this first factor is friendship because I agree with Eugene Peterson, wrote a book on this, and I agree with him. He says, it is highly unlikely that David would ever have made it without Jonathan. That he probably would have become a bitter, angry young man. But God gave him, first of all, a godly friendship with someone like Jonathan. Now, Jonathan and David came from different social classes, rich, poor. They came from different backgrounds, shepherd, king's son. But they both had a passion for God. They had an incredible passion for God. That's what knit them together. Jonathan was able to look beyond surfaces. Jonathan just looked at David and said, what can I get out of this guy? But Jonathan saw beneath David, beneath the surface, all of his qualities from God, his weaknesses. And he didn't categorize them. We meet very few people meet us and see us on the inside. And don't label us, characterize us, figure out what can they get from me, how can they use me. Very few people see you like that. It's a great thing to be a Jonathan to someone. That is a rare, rare, rare person. But without a Jonathan, David risked abandoning his vocation of God calling him to be king. He could have ended up returning to develop sheep, who knows, to tend sheep. But it's not unusual for us to begin well. It's not unusual for people to begin life with all kinds of hopes and dreams of what I'm going to be, but it's very unusual for people to finish. It's very unusual to find people that carry on long-term when suffering, loss, disappointment hits their life to continue to be faithful and passionate for God and to continue that spiral journey upward and grow into some mature person and really be qualified to serve as a king and bless other people. But none of Saul's evil ever gets inside of David. It's just amazing. He's surrounded by evil, but it doesn't get in him. And one factor I believe is very much Jonathan. If you remember, a couple of years ago, I did a series on Proverbs, and one of the messages was on friendship. And, most of us, we have, the three categories of friendships, and we have about 500 to 2,500 acquaintances. Then we've got maybe a small group of 20 to 100 casual friends. But you only have one or two really intimate close friends you can actually handle, and probably in your life. And Proverbs speaks a lot about a righteous man is cautious in friendship. He who walks with the wise grows wise. And the Bible speaks so much about the importance of healthy friendship and how bad company corrupts good morals. But if you want to be a wise, godly person, we hook up with some wise, godly people. If you want to be a sluggard, you're going to hang out with sluggards. But you know what it's like? When you're angry and bitter, you look for angry, bitter people. Jonathan and David hook up here in a friendship that is godly, that is beautiful, that is not self-serving. We search with a vengeance to find the right doctors and lawyers and accountants, but few of us search with a vengeance to find the right friends. David and Jonathan have a friendship that, in a sense, functions as a boundaries for him to walk with God. In fact, chapter 18 and 20, it ends, chapter 20 ends with their friendship and it begins with their friendship in chapter 18. It's kind of, their friendship brackets this whole story of him running from Saul. Because it was such an important element in his ability to go on that slow spiral upward. If you think that you can do it alone, you're kidding yourself. That's why we believe in cells and communities. But somehow, God has to knit us with one or two people that really are soulmates, that are friends, with whom we can share our depth of our souls and walk with God with a passion. But friends, we all need it. If David needed it, you better believe it. You do too. One of my passions for New Life is that we're creating a counterculture here for youth, for children, for families, for singles, of relationships that are healthy. because we need each other to walk out the radical life God's called us to. David was not called to walk it out alone. But there's one other thing, go down to the second key factor, and that is he keeps going back, he keeps remembering the living God. And this I want to drive home and close with this, because remember in David and Goliath, David walked into that situation, everybody's afraid, but he can't imagine looking at anything in life without remembering the living God. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that would defy the armies of the living God? Because David's always thinking, the living God. And so when David walks, everything's falling apart. You got to imagine, he loses his wife. He loses his best friend. He loses Jonathan. He loses Samuel, his mentor. He loses his reputation. He loses his job. He loses his money. I don't know about you. I'd be going crazy. But he, even in this, remembers the living God. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know why it's going on. He doesn't know if he's going to be dead next week. But somehow, through it all, he has his struggles. And let me say, he's going through the same emotions as Saul. Anger, jealousy, bitterness. They're all passing through his soul. He's a human being. And in fact, if you read the Psalms, why do we love the Psalms? Because we relate to his depression, his anger, his frustration, him raging out at God. We love it. That's why we love the Psalms. But he allows that depression and anxiety to become part of his soul, and he brings it to God. Saul doesn't bring it to God. Saul just keeps carrying it, and it keeps getting worse and worse downward. Now, go to Psalm 56. And I want you to read two Psalms. Go to Psalm 56 and Psalm 63. Psalm 56. Because David is writing Psalms during this time. Saul is basically writing strategy to hold on to the kingship. He's controlling, planning, fixing, figuring this thing out to hold on to power. David is basically in worship. He's running for his life, but he is writing music. And he's wrestling with God in his music. And so in Psalm 56, he says, be merciful, verse 1, be merciful to me, O God, for men hotly pursue me all day long, and they press their attack. My slanderers pursue me all day long. Many are attacking me in their pride. When I am afraid, I will trust in you. In God, whose word I praise. In God I trust, I will not be afraid. What can mortal man do to me? He's just crying out for mercy. He's bringing it to God. He's wrestling with God. And look at verse 8. Record my lament. Basically, that means record my misery. He's miserable. Record it, God. List my tears on your scroll. That can be either on a book, God, write them on a scroll, or the word there in Hebrew is for a bottle. Put my tears in your bottle for wine or water. God, will you just carry my tears with you? And are they not in your record? But he's bringing his pain, his loss, but he's going to the living God with it. And he doesn't know what's happening, but he knows God's sovereign. And somehow God is the living God and God is good. And if God's going to somehow use this for my good, others' good, and his glory, and I don't know where it's going, but I'm coming to the living God who's in control and running this whole show. And look at Psalm 63. He writes this too while he's in the desert. I love this. Oh God, you're my God. Verse 1, earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. I have seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and your glory. Because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you. You know, Saul's saying, God, to be king is better than life. For Saul, for David, it's your love, oh God, is better than life. Do you know, why was David suffering? Well, it was his good, others' good, and God's glory. We wouldn't have these Psalms if David didn't suffer. And do you know what? Hebrews 5:8 says, Jesus learned obedience from what he suffer. It says in Hebrews 2:10 that Jesus was made perfect through his suffering. Write down this verse. 1 Peter 4:1 says, since Jesus suffered in his body, and you yourselves have the same attitude, because he who has suffered in his body is done with sin. When you suffer, something is broken in you. God leads David to loss, disappointment, frustration, pain for years. But God is breaking the power of sin in David. God is perfecting David. Just like Jesus learned obedience from what he suffered, David is learning obedience. He goes slowly, and I say slowly, upward, that spiral road. And it's a slow, as you know, when you're wrestling, it's slow. You feel like it's slow? I wish God would put me on a helicopter and boost me to the top. But he makes me walk up the spiral staircase. But David needed these experiences to mature and to grow up. So let me just apply some of you, two applications. One is this. Some of you are on a Saul path, and God's stopping you today. You're angry, you're jealous, you're frustrated with God. You've stopped listening to him in some area of your life. You've become selective. You're doing your own thing. Now, your choice. When you don't like what God's doing, you can medicate yourself and find some pleasure, some addiction, something to medicate the pain. Or you can take your pain and bring it to the cross. And you can die. And you can bring it to God. But everything that is in the darkness needs to be exposed in the light. And I want to do is I want to invite you this morning. Is it says in Ephesians 5, everything exposed by the light becomes visible, for it is the light that makes everything visible. I don't believe that we can repent apart from grace. It takes grace to come to the light. But as we come to the light, and David just kept bringing his stuff to the light, to the living God. He kept remembering the living God. And he had a friend named Jonathan pushing him to remember. Maybe you don't have anybody pushing you. Come on, now hang with it. Don't get bitter. Don't run away. But I'm doing that for you this morning. And we stand this morning with each other saying, come on, go to the living God. Don't go down. Don't take that path of self-destruction. The temptation is to fight like Saul or to run away, to flee. Or you can say, you know what? I'm weak, but I'm going to go through the pain that it might become part of me and transform me and make me more like Jesus. And I'm weak, God, but you're strong. I'm going to invite, come on forward, Linda. And some of you are on a soul path. Others of you are confused and you're saying, why is this happening to me? And my answer to you is, I don't know. But God does know. And you can rest assured of this, that nothing comes into your life except with the permission of God. Every loss, every disappointment, every frustration, every setback. And David points us to Jesus who went before us. And I want to invite you, like David in Psalm 63, to stick with the living God this morning and to surrender. They're going to sing that song they sang at the offering. And I'm going to invite you to listen to it and respond back to God. And let this be your prayer. It's my prayer this morning to surrender. This is not a sprint, friends. It's a marathon. And it was for David. But God's got something for you. So let's surrender this morning.